Hello and welcome back to Slightly Fox. This podcast is for readers who like to get off the beaten track. So the obscure, the recondite and the esoteric are meat and drink to everyone here, but only if they're also good reads. Today, we're holed up in the corner of the office because most of it is occupied by stacks of books and quarterlies, all waiting to be packaged up and dispatched as Christmas orders. My name is Philippa Lamb, and as usual, the Slightly Fox founders are with me.
Hello, I'm Gail Perkis, and I'm one of the editors.
And I'm Hazel Wood, and I'm the other.
And we have another of the foxes.
Yes, hello, I'm Jenny, and I've been at Slightly Fox for, I think, about 12 years now. I came on Christmas to help out with some envelope stuffing, and I've essentially never left. I've been here ever since, and now I have a very happy job of looking after the website, doing the newsletters, doing our Instagram feed, and designing catalogues, and have a very nice time all around.
Nice mix. We record this podcast at the kitchen table, so there will, I'm afraid, be interruptions from phones and deliveries, and irritatingly this time, builder's noise, for which apologies. But we haven't so far heard from the office dogs, who don't seem to be here. We have Tarko, which is Jenny's whippet, who was always good as gold.
Well, he is, except he's just destroyed his bed, very silently.
As long as it's silent. That's fine. But we don't have Chudley and Stanley.
No, Chudley and Stanley, I'm afraid they're in Devon at the moment, and they're having a lovely time down there. And to be honest, they'd much rather be there than in the office.
Well, yes, frankly, without wishing to be rude, we're not sorry not to have them. They were very vocal last time. So what have we got for you today? Well, every month, as you know, we like to give you a peep into what's going on at Hoxton Square. And it is clear from the state of the office, you are all extremely busy right now.
Yes, we've had several extremely large deliveries. In fact, the first delivery was so big that they had to split it because the van was over its capacity. Oh. And we've already got at least 100 boxes in the office. They're full of good things. They're full of Ernest Shepherd's two delightful memoirs about his childhood. He was the man who illustrated Winnie the Pooh and Wind in the Willows. And we've got a Country Doctor's Commonplace book by the lovely Philip Evans, which is flying out of the door. And we've got our latest issue, our 60th issue.
Yes. The other big news is Reader's Day, isn't it? You had Reader's Day recently.
We did, and it was, I think it was our most successful yet. It was our eighth.
You need to tell people what it is.
Yes.
Well, it's a day when we get together with our subscribers, and we have five speakers who are in some way associated with Slightly Foxed, and they talk about their own particular literary interests. But the nice thing about Reader's Day is that it's not a sort of selling exercise, as so often literary festivals are, and we have only 100 tickets.
And that's because it's very little, isn't it? It's a really lovely building,
yes,
but
it's
small.
A lovely place.
It's a beautiful Georgian building, the Artworkers Guild, and sometime just before the First World War, they added a little lecture hall on at the back, which is the most enchanting room. It's got a lantern window, and it's panelled, and on the walls are the portraits of the masters, and I'm glad to say in some cases now the mistresses.
Yes. It is really lovely, and you had some fantastic speakers this year.
We did. We had Miranda Seymour talking about Byron's wife and daughter, very spiritedly. And we had a young Don called Edmund Gordon, whose first biography won the Best First Biography Prize, which we give every year. And he wrote about Angela Carter, and that was fascinating. Penelope Lively and Ursula Buchan in conversation about gardens. There's a cooperative, they're a collective. They used to be based in Norfolk, called St Jude's, run by Simon and Angie Lewin. Angie Lewin is a wonderful illustrator.
Famous illustrator.
It was a lovely discussion about how they approach illustration and how they approach design.
Because we're thinking we might do an episode on that, aren't we? Because obviously you're very associated with illustration and book illustration.
Yes,
so we're thinking
absolutely.
Maybe next year we might do an entire episode.
Yes.
And one last thing that we're really looking forward to is our annual writers competition. So we've invited all subscribers to enter, and they have to write a 1,000-word piece on an author or a book they love. And the deadline is the 31st of March next year, and the prize is £250, and the piece will be published. So we're very much hoping that we have as many entries as we did last year.
Yes, which was a very good year, wasn't it?
We had four wonderful articles.
Very hard to choose.
And Jenny, we only started making this podcast last month. It seems longer, I have to say. But it's gone well, hasn't it, so far? You've been tracking it.
We have, yeah. I mean, we've had a really lovely response to the first episode. We've had people putting comments on Instagram and phoning up the office.
And telling you where they've been listening, because that's what I liked best.
Some of them, one of our cover artists, Luna North, who did our autumn cover, she wrote in to say that she had listened to it in her studio while carving.
Oh, that's a nice thought.
And another subscriber wrote and said, "Good morning from the Rockies, I'm listening in my pyjamas." And I'm afraid we did have one reader who is actually one of our favourite subscribers. She's in her 80s and is incredibly sparky. And she sent us a message saying, "Dear Slightly Foxed, I am one of your devoted members, but being ancient, I do not know what a podcast is. Yours sincerely." So we're not going to try and persuade her.
No?
But, well, do you think we ought
yes,
to?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, maybe we could get her into the office and she could come and listen to it with us, perhaps.
We have a busy podcast today, and since this series is all about rediscovering great books, we're going to be discussing the importance of the printed word. And to give us an historical perspective on that, we'll be joined by the eminent librarian, writer and sinologue, Francis Wood. And we're using one of Francis's own pieces for Slightly Foxed as our specially recorded work from the archive this time. It's about the origins of paper and the wonderfully named Diamond Sutra. Later, of course, we will have book recommendations, as you'd expect, and we'll hear from some Slightly Foxed subscribers, because at the Reader's Day we were just chatting about, we recorded them talking about the books they are planning to give as gifts this Christmas. But first, Jenny, Gail, Hazel, we don't want to retread the old debate about print versus screen, because obviously both have a role to play, and indeed you have your own digital edition, but we do want to explore why paper is such a seductive material. And I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, the pleasure of reading, it does have a great deal to do with the physicality of books.
Yes, absolutely. When I was publishing new books, when copies arrived from the printer, the very first thing I used to do was to feel through its pages and feel the binding and actually smell it.
Yes.
And I always used to recommend to authors that they did the same, because Sod's Law was that if they opened the book, they would invariably find a typo. It would be the only typo in the book. But so just to enjoy the physical object, there's nothing that can beat that. So when I think of a book and think of a story, I immediately think of the edition in which I read it.
Yes, it's a kind of multi-dimensional experience, as it were. And of course it is very important, the quality of paper.
Secondhand books, I mean, I'm a lifelong fan of secondhand books, but as you say, it is about the paper quality and those mid-century books where there's that felty quality to the paper, and Victorian books where it's paper thin.
Yes, yes. The materials that they used in general have worn so well. And of course they're all sewn, the pages are sewn together, it's not glue like most modern paperbacks, which will fall to pieces in 20 years' time.
I mean, as you say, the thing about sewing rather than gluing, is that still done?
Well, we do it for Slightly Foxed.
Do you?
Unusually, we do it for the magazine, which is very rare.
They're lovely objects. We'll talk a bit more about them later, but I think let me first bring in our guest, Frances Wood, because she knows a great deal more about the history of books and paper than any of us, I think. She's a former curator of the Chinese collection at the British Library. It is Chinese books, I think, in particular, isn't it, that have been your area of study?
Yes, yes, Chinese books. I hope I read practically every Victorian missionary's account of going to China. I mean, I'd read anything about China, doesn't matter how rubbishy it is.
Because you went there when you were very... You read Chinese at Cambridge and then you went on a student exchange, is that right, to China?
Yes.
And
yes.
When was that?
1975. We didn't know it at the time, but it was the last year of the Cultural Revolution. So we went off to, yes, to Cultural Revolution China, China of the Red Guards, the worker, peasant, soldier ethos, and we were compelled, as it were, to join in. We weren't, unfortunately, allowed to be soldiers. We were rather sad about that. But as workers, we went off to railway engine factories and stood around holding screws and bits and pieces. And we did quite a lot of agricultural work and digging holes, transplanting rice in trial fields, which was again hopeless. All my little bits of rice used to keep floating away whenever I tried to stick them in the ground.
So you're quite undermining the revolution.
Yes. And we dug underground shelters in Peking University in case the Russians launched a nuclear attack.
I heard you did a bit of hand grenade throwing practice. Is that right?
Well, that was being a standard student. And we had compulsory sport every, I think it was Wednesday afternoon. And the sports were a bit different. There was discus throwing and there was hand grenade throwing.
Bit different.
Yeah, the British Council was paying for us to learn how to throw hand grenades. But, I mean, we spent a lot of time pretending we were taking the pin out with our teeth
of
and
course.
Then, you know, chucking the hand grenade away and so on.
Was there any reading matter to be had? I mean, other than the Little Red Book.
Fortunately for us, there was a library in the British Embassy. They have a sort of social club and they had masses of racks of Penguin classics. But I discovered that there were little bits of Peking University Library that we were allowed into. I found a whole kind of stack which was stuffed with books which must have been accumulated, I won't say nicked. Things like Rambles in Dorset and...
English language books.
English, a whole okay. load of kind of wonderfully slightly foxed and smelling of, you know, old book type books. The one book that I do remember, which absolutely excited me passionately, was a book we were told to read in our history class. We were told to read a biography of the first Ming Emperor, which had been written by a man who subsequently went down, as it were, in the Cultural Revolution. He was almost the first victim of the Cultural Revolution, Wu Han, who was a massive historian. And we had to go in, we had to sign it out from Peking University Library. You had to have a chitty from your teacher saying, you know, I have instructed this student to read this very bad book. Because
right.
it was negative teaching material,
yes.
it was described as. And so you could take this book out, but only for 2 days. And I took it back and I read it. I didn't sleep. I read it all night. And my roommate, who was Chinese, then read it the next night. And it was the most exciting book.
I'm intrigued that you were still allowed to read it. I would have expected it to be burnt if it was no longer considered appropriate.
Well, China has an immensely long history of emperors banning books. But what they did usually was to keep one copy for the Imperial Library and then make everybody else burn theirs.
Right.
So books have survived in China, most extraordinarily, through many literary inquisitions and persecutions.
Tell us about the British Library collection, because it's huge, isn't it?
It is huge, and it's not the same as something, say, like the Library of Congress. It's not the same as even the Bodleian Library has, in a sense, a slightly more serious collection. What I love about the British Library collection is that it, being a kind of national library, you know, in the old days, I suppose people find a Chinese book in the attic and they think, what shall I do with it? And they think, well, I'll take it to the British Library and see what. And we took in all sorts of things. In the 18th and 19th century, people collected Chinese books and they ended up in the British Library. And one of the lovely things about them is that many of them are illustrated. I mean, these were collected by Europeans who happened to be in China or had some connection. And, you know, strolling the streets of Guangzhou in 1790 or whatever, they would see books and send them back to England. And now the illustrated things are often very cheap, cheerful fiction with pictures of people sort of disemboweling each other and slicing each other up and riding around on horses and so on. You know, these. So they brought back these picture books, which don't survive in China, because no one in China would have given house room in their library to such sort of trash.
So it's tat, really.
But, I mean, 18th century trash or 17th century trash is no longer trash.
Absolutely. Yeah. Tell us about the greatest treasure of all there, this wonderful... It's a scroll, isn't it, rather than a book, the Diamond Sutra.
The Diamond Sutra, yes, the world's earliest securely dated, printed, and then one always says sort of book in inverted commas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because the way that Chinese books evolved was that they started out as scrolls, started out on long rolls of paper. Well, actually, they started off as being written on strips of bamboo, which were then tied together and rolled up, rather like a bamboo roller blind.
Right.
And so the first paper books, they reperform that format, that the scroll is like a bamboo roller blind, but in paper. So once paper becomes really popular in China, from about the 4th century AD, books are in that form, and it's not until the 12th, 13th century that they started using pages in the way, you know, they started foliating books in the way that we do. But the Diamond Sutra, it's wonderful. I mean, it's nearly 30 feet long. It's composed of long sheets of paper, each one woodblock printed. Now, it's produced in 868 AD, so it's about 500 years before Gutenberg, 400 years or so before paper really gets used in Europe. So it's a completely unique and wonderful thing. But the printing, the size, the shape of the characters is absolutely glorious.
And this was for mass distribution, is that right?
That's right, yes. The great thing about it is the right at the very end, there's a printed colophon which says that it was produced in 868 AD, by someone called Wang Jie. One longs to know who he was. on behalf of his two parents, Wei Erqin, which is very sweet, for universal distribution. Because for Buddhists, reproducing the words of the Buddha or an image of the Buddha means that you accrue merit.
Repetition.
Printing was really, we think, very largely propelled forwards by Buddhism.
Now, you wrote a piece for Foxt about the Dhamma Sutra. This seems like the perfect moment to hear some of it. It's read for us by Andrew Hawkins.
It is not surprising that having invented paper over 2,000 years ago, the Chinese found a variety of ways to use it. Though the 17th century landscape artist and arbiter of taste, Wang Zhenghong, considered painted wallpaper vulgar, Chinese painted wallpaper depicting birds, flowers, garden architecture and butterflies became popular in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. In 1794, the first British ambassador to China, Lord Macartney, even brought back a set painted with scenes of Chinese streets and workshops for his banker, Mr. Coutts, which can still be seen in the boardroom on the Strand in London. Paper was used for wrapping from the 2nd century BC, for writing soon after, for making fans and oiled umbrellas from the 3rd century AD, and for kites and lanterns from the 5th century, when lavatory paper was also first manufactured. A sheet of standard toilet paper was over half a metre wide, made from straw, wood, oil and lime, and stamped with a red mark, while special soft paper was provided for the emperor. We are fortunate that an enormous archive was discovered at an abandoned Buddhist cave temple complex in 1900. On the edge of the dry Gobi Desert, one small cave in the complex had been filled with manuscripts and paintings and closed about 1,000 years earlier. The dry climate and the ceiling of the cave meant that the papers were perfectly preserved. More than 20,000 manuscripts and a very small number of printed items were brought back to London and now reside in the British Library. The earliest dated paper manuscript from Dunhuang was copied in AD 406 and the latest probably just after AD 1000. The range of paper is quite extraordinary and provides a variety of sensory delights. The best manuscripts of Buddhist sutras were copied in shiny black ink on fine paper dyed deep yellow. The dye, produced from the bark of the Amur cork tree, was also a protective insecticide. At the other end of the spectrum are papers that are more like fabric, soft yet strong and sometimes reused. The greatest find at Dunhuang was a printed copy of the Buddhist Diamond Sutra. Over 8 meters long, its frontispiece depicts the Buddha surrounded by acolytes, monks, and flying Buddhist angels. Once the significance of the Diamond Sutra was recognized, it was treated with great respect in the British Museum bindery in the first decades of the 20th century. Unfortunately, this meant it was mounted several times with new, often unsuitable paper backings applied. Mark Barnard began the painstaking job of easing off the various backings on the Diamond Sutra. Using only water, a pair of Japanese tweezers made of an impossibly light space-age metal, and a Russian dentist scraper, Mark moved slowly, never knowing what he would find under each layer of backing and never certain that the original paper might not have been damaged beyond salvage by earlier treatments. The conservation studio has wide north-facing windows where conservators work in silence. The process of removing the backings, which involves moistening them first, is a very slow business. Too much moisture and Mark runs the risk of damaging the paper. Too little and the same thing could happen. Working on 10 centimeters at a time, Mark has taken 7 years to reach the frontispiece. But the transformation is quite extraordinary. The sutra had been held fast by its hard backing and was cracking upwards, but as each printed sheet was released, it almost seemed to float free. It is even possible to see the imprint of the printer's block onto which the paper was pressed well over 1,000 years ago. Now that the backings have been removed, scholars will be able to study the construction of the paper properly and advance our knowledge of early printing in the Far East.
Is that restoration work still going on?
No, it's finished. I wrote that in 2014 and wrote it really to celebrate the end of 7 years of tremendously hard work by Mark, which needed celebrating. You know, can you imagine? It's like, you know, what are you doing? You're touching up the Mona Lisa or something.
Yes,
you know?
I mean,
but in the end, he's done the most astounding job. You know, there are, what, 24,000 items on paper from that cave, and they are in beautiful condition.
Isn't that amazing?
The paper is just stunning. And it's not just, I mean, the paper the Diamond Sutra is printing on is quite, you were talking before, it's quite sort of felty. But if you look at the paper that manuscripts were written on, they were often very highly burnished papers. So they're really shiny and bright yellow. And if you can sort of wave them a bit, and they make an amazing crinkling noise.
Well, I'm afraid the Slightly Fox paper may not last quite that long.
What do you use? Your paper is lovely.
We use something which is made specially for us by a paper mill. When we started, I asked the printer, I said, I want a nice cream paper. And at the time, we were very taken with Hortus, the Gardening Quarterly. And I think they were using this particular paper, and so we sort of took over.
And you've been up to the printers, haven't you, Jenny, and seen the paper?
Yeah, I've been up a couple of times. In fact, we had a couple of occasions where we invited subscribers to also come up to the printers. And Don and Tracy showed them round and showed them how the machines work. They showed us how they make the film and the plates. And it's so atmospheric. There's something about it. It's just the noise of the, you know, these giant machines kind of whirring away, and it's, you can just see the paper rolling off.
And where is this?
So this is up in Yorkshire. They're called Smith Settle. They've since moved from Settle to
Yeadon in Wharfdale. In fact, there's a 2-minute film on our website called Birth of a Book, which the Daily Telegraph commissioned some years ago, and that will take you from the filmmaking to the finished product.
Filmmaking?
Yes, sorry. Once we've got final camera-ready artwork, they actually do take a picture of it, which is then, by alchemy, converted into printing plates, which are wrapped around the rollers on the machine.
One thing that comes to me, Frances, earlier on you used the expression slightly foxed as a description. Am I right in thinking you came up with the name for the Quarterly?
Yes, I remember discussing it with Gail years and years ago, and just looking in very boring books about bibliography, you know, kind of foliation and octavo and duodecimo and so on.
But it is a genuine antiquarian term, isn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely.
And we,
you should
point,
say what it means. Maybe people probably don't know.
Well, it means slight spotting on pages of old paper.
That brown spotting you get on old
books. That brown speckling that you get. So you can be fully foxed. You can be slightly foxed. But at the time, it was an absolute lifesaver with Frances. I can remember the phone call vividly because we had got a long list of possible titles, most of which were as dull as ditch water.
Such as?
Oh, God, you know, Ink and Paper, The Reader's Quarterly, the... I can't even remember.
We did The Questing Vole for a while, didn't we?
Well, yes, we did The Questing Vole after.
But then I think somebody else had used it.
Oh, no,
from Scoop.
Scoop, yeah.
Yes, when Frances suggested Slightly Fox, I mean, it made me laugh out loud. And we kept on sort of lurching away from it because it was so quirky, and then coming back to it. And
little double meaning as well, because it was the time of Borders and enormous book supermarkets, really. And, you know, one had this picture of people going into these places and not being able to find anything at all among all these glossy new books. So we wanted to point them in another direction, yes, towards the backlists.
Happily, of course, for book lovers, Christmas, which is coming, is a great time for book giving and receiving. We do, of course, have some recommendations on that front. But first, we thought it would be nice to hear from some Slightly Fox subscribers. We recorded them at Reader's Day that we were talking about earlier on. And we ran in amongst them and asked them which books they would like to give or receive this Christmas. Christmas books, what are you hoping to get?
Certainly the Angela Carter biography by Edmund Gordon. I live in Margate in Kent, and there was a book by David Seabrook called All the Devils Are Here, which is a sort of travelogue, psychogeography book about the area. So that's on my Christmas list as well.
The new Jonathan Coe novel. I'd also like the Peter Frankopan book about the new Silk Roads. Max Hastings on Vietnam. My mother is a voracious reader. She loves thrillers and stuff like that. I've just read the latest Philip Kerr, so I'll probably give that to her, which is called Greeks Bearing Gifts, which I really enjoyed. The other book that I've read recently that I really enjoyed that I think she might too is Germaine Greer wrote a book called White Beach about having a piece of rainforest in southeast Queensland. And it's absolutely fascinating about the history of Australia, botany.
I'd quite like to read Erebus by Michael Palin.
Do you have a book in mind that you're really hoping you'll get for Christmas?
I think Sebastian Fuchs, the latest one, but Paris Echo. I've bought BB books for a granddaughter.
Brendan Chase,
yes. I read them to my children when they were younger, and then they took them up too.
I've just finished reading Churchill's biography. I think with the passing of time, people are getting a lot less hagiographic about Churchill.
Well, there's the book by the GP, The Diary.
The one that Slightly Fox has just published.
Yes, and in fact, I have asked my husband to give it to me.
The biography of Anthony Powell. His biography was remarkably similar to the biography of John le Carré. They both had dodgy fathers, and that was fascinating.
I'm Penelope Lively. There's a book that I thought was wonderful this year, which is by Caris Davis. It's her first novel. She's published, I think, a couple of collections of extraordinarily good short stories, and this is a very short novel called West. It's set in America in the 19th century, and I would strongly recommend that.
I would not mind getting some of the books from the book along list that I haven't yet read, including the Sally Rooney and the Rachel Kushner, in fact, I'm looking forward to as well.
Have you bought any to give yet?
I haven't yet, no. It's far too early for me to have done my Christmas shopping.
Well, it might be too early for him. It's not too early for us. Recommendations, please.
Every other November, I get a book off my shelves in the kitchen because I need to make Christmas puddings. And the cookery book I fall back on every single time is Katie Stewart's Times Cookbook, which I basically grew up on. First published in 1972. Still a Bible. Still incredibly reliable, deeply unfashionable, not in the least bit flashy, but my goodness, her chocolate roulade, her Christmas pudding, her Seville orange marmalade, unbeatable.
Okay. Hazel.
I just so agree with Gail about Katie Stewart. And sort of along those lines, I'm going to recommend a book which is really a sort of anti-cookbook.
Okay.
It's called The Pedant in the Kitchen by Julian Barnes. It's almost about the sort of psychology of cooking, really. Julian Barnes was never taught to cook, and the same applies to me, so he's rather a troubled cook, and he's also a very text-based cook, as he puts it. He follows recipes, and he follows them to the letter. But, of course, there are an awful lot of things that worry him in the kitchen, and particularly in instructions in cookbooks. For example, you know, what is a medium onion
when you've
got onions of all sizes? What is a sort of glug of oil or
a handful.
I mean, everybody's hands are different sizes, you know. He advises against getting those cookbooks with beautiful pictures in. He also says that, you know, the relationship between a sort of cookbook author and the person who's trying to do the recipe is usually rather like a sort of sexual encounter. You know, one person is much more experienced than the other, and the other person should always have the right to say, I'm not going to do that. You know, I am not going to take the seeds out of a tomato.
Life is too short to stuff them out.
Life is too short. It's just the most incredibly entertaining book. Very sort of wry and funny. I just loved it. So.
Jenny.
Oh, well,
follow that.
If we're on the theme of cookery books, just a quick mention for my favourite Christmas cookery book, which is Nigel Slater's Christmas Chronicles, and I've got a lovely copy of it. It's hardback, and it sits on my shelf in my kitchen dresser, and it just makes me feel seasonal. But I also just wanted to mention of something that caught my eye on Twitter, actually, the other day, which is from the Book Trust, which is a wonderful charity. And I saw that they are running a campaign to help vulnerable children in care, or vulnerable children or children who are in care.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't know what you would like to give someone for Christmas, you could donate to their campaign and they will send a festive book parcel, which is made up of 6 books. And you can donate between £10 up to £100 or more. And for every £10, they will send one of these parcels.
That's a great idea.
And I just thought, actually, what a lovely thing to do. And if you want to find out more, you can visit their website, which is booktrust.org.uk. And you can follow the hashtag festivebookparcel. So I'm definitely going to be doing that for some of my friends and family.
That is an excellent idea. Now, Frances, just to wrap this up, I hear that you're a detective fiction fan, which I have to say I was a bit surprised about.
Well, I think one has to relax.
I have to tear myself away
from Buddhist texts of the, you know, 4th century BC. And yes, I love detective stories. The one Chinese I know who's writing, he writes his detective stories actually in English. I mean, he was born and brought up in China and left really at quite a late age. But Qiu Xiaolong has produced, I think, about 5 or 6 now. The difficulty, I think, about poor old Qiu Xiaolong is that he has a very difficult name, that Qiu is Q-I-U. Ah. And then his given name, Xiaolong, which means small dragon, begins with an X. And so it's actually incredibly difficult to find in a bookshop.
I see the problem.
But I recommend particularly, there's one, I think it's called When Red Turns to Black, which was actually based on the real-life murder of a real-life novelist in China, who's one of whose novels I actually translated into English. So I was quite intrigued by that. And she was murdered by jealous relatives because she'd made so much money, which is a very contemporary Chinese story.
And those are available here if you can find them in a bookshop.
Mm, yes, yes. Look around in a bookshop.
And Frances, you've been far too modest. You haven't mentioned the book that you wrote about your time in China at the end of the Cultural Revolution, Hand Grenade Practice in Peking, which is a delightful memoir, which I had the privilege of publishing at John Murray. And then we issued it as a Slightly Fox edition, and now we have it as a Slightly Fox paperback.
That's about all we have time for this month, I think. But thank you very much to our guest, Frances Wood. We'll be back on January the 15th with another episode when we'll be talking about the art and science of editing with guest author and creative writing teacher, Sue G.
So that's the end of our second podcast, and we've tremendously enjoyed doing it, I must say, and I hope that you've enjoyed it as well. It feels a great way to somehow talk directly to our subscribers and other people who might be interested in Slightly Foxed. So goodbye for now, and Jenny is going to tell you how to actually access our podcast in case, like some of us, you're not wizardly technical.
If you don't want to do the app thing, because not everyone is a great fan of the smartphone, you can listen on the website, can't you? What's the address?
Yeah, absolutely. You can visit foxedquarterly.com/pod, where you'll find each episode, and you can simply hit the play button and listen to it there and then. Or if you prefer, you can subscribe using iTunes or your other favourite podcast listening app. But it is good to go to the website, because there you'll find our show notes, which include links to the books that we've mentioned, to articles that sort of, if you want to read further around a subject that we've talked about.
And Olivia's typing those up.
She's very diligently taking notes.
So, yeah, and while you're there, do take a look around, find out about Slightly Fox, and if you can escape their online bookshop without buying anything, all I can say is you have more self-discipline than I do. We will be back next year on January 15th. Thanks for joining us off the beaten track.